Hello, this is Laurie Jacobson, Hollywood author with all the scoop on Hollywood mysteries, scandals, ghosts, and the Beatles at Shea Stadium. And I'm the next guest on Screen and Beyond.
On Screen and Beyond, an inside look into the entertainment world featuring interviews with people from the movie, TV, and music industry, news on upcoming TV and DVD releases, and the rumor mill. And now, here's the host of On Screen and Beyond, Brian Zemrak.
We are back for another edition of On Screen and Beyond. This is episode 623 of the show that keeps you updated on what's coming your way as far as upcoming new movies, remakes, sequels, and TV and movie DVD releases, as well as our interview segment with a guest from the movie, TV, or music industry. This week on Screen and Beyond, we are going to be talking with a writer, producer, author, and she was the co-producer of the Mary Tyler Moore 20th anniversary show back in 1991. And she also produced some other things like the Suzanne Summers Show. And she's written several books, and they're great books. Her latest book that's out is called Top of the Mountain, The Beatles at Shea Stadium, 1965. So Laurie Jacobson is going to be coming to On Screen and Beyond in just a few minutes. So I hope you're going to stick around for that. It's going to be a fascinating interview, and we'll have a lot of fun with that. So that's coming up in a few minutes right here on Screen and Beyond. Also want to remind you, on May 26th through the 28th, at the Arinda Theater in Arinda, California, there's going to be Behind the Golden Curtain. Now, this is a tribute to the Golden Girls TV show, and it's a convention, and there's going to be all kinds of guests there who are associated with the show, the Golden Girls, the writers, directors, producers, and people who guest starred on episodes of the Golden Girls. And I'll be giving you more information on who those people are in future episodes here of On Screen and Beyond. They're also going to have panel discussions and trivia and lectures and parties and a whole lot more. Be sure to check that out on May 26th to the 28th at the Arinda Theater in Arinda, California. And I think if you go to arindatheater.com, they may have information up on it already. I'm not sure, but you can check that out and see what they have there. So be sure to check that out. And what do you say? It's time to get into Remake Madness right here on Screen and Beyond.
Please hang up and try again.
Remake Madness, well, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem brings back sewer dwellers once more, and this time with Seth Rogen. And it hits the theaters on August 4th. And you can look for Jake Gyllenhaal to star in a remake of Roadhouse. Now, that's the 1989 film, which starred Patrick Swayze. And that's it for Remake Madness. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, what's coming your way as far as upcoming new movies? Upcoming new movies, Matt Damon and Casey Affleck have joined forces once again, and they will star in The Instigators for an Apple original film. Nicolas Cage will star in a horror thriller called The Long Legs, and Blair Underwood has also signed on. And Mila Kunis and Michael Keaton are going to be joining their forces to star in a comedy called Goodrich, and the filming starts next month. And that's it for upcoming new movies. Next and On Screen and Beyond, we're going to take a peek at what's coming your way as far as sequels. Sequels. March 24th, John Wick Chapter 4 finally jumps into theaters, and Sam Raimi says a sequel to Drag Me to Hell is possible. The team is trying to come up with a story that would work. That's what he says. And October 4th, 2024, that's the current release date of Joker Folie à Deux. All right, and that's it for sequels. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, what's coming your way as far as movies and TV on DVD. Movies and TV on DVD, Cliffhanger with Sylvester Stallone, which they are going to be making a remake, or they're working on it anyways. It is celebrating its 30th anniversary on May 30th with a 4K Ultra HD limited edition steelbook release. And on May 2nd, Baby Ruby, a psychological thriller, will be hitting DVD and on demand. April 18th, we got a couple of things coming your way. You can get Marlowe with Liam Neeson. Now, this is Liam's 100th film, and it's in theaters right now. It's going to be available on Blu-ray and DVD. And Magic Mike's Last Dance will be strolling on to Blu-ray and DVD on April 18th. That's it for movies and TV on DVD. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, it's TV and entertainment time. TV and entertainment time. Well, Disney CEO Bob Iger, he says that it's what everybody's been saying, that Disney theme parks are getting too expensive. Well, duh. We'll see what he does about it, if anything. And Kevin Costner will host and be executive producer to a show for the History Channel. And it's a documentary style show. And he is going to be working on that. The working title is called Kevin Costner's The West. And sadly, in passings, we've had Robert Blake this past week from Beretta in the 70s. He passed away at 89. And Burt I. Gordon. Now, he was giving us all kinds of sci-fi movies back in the 50s and early 60s. He has passed at the age of 100. Now, Burt I. Gordon was a guest here at On Screen and Beyond, so if you want to learn more about him, you can hear Burt talk about his career on episode 207 of On Screen and Beyond. So be sure to check that out. And that's it for TV and entertainment time. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, we are going to be talking with Lori Jacobson. She's a writer, producer, historian. She knows all kinds of things about Hollywood, and she has been a producer on TV shows, and her latest book out to Top of the Mountain, The Beatles at Shea Stadium, 1965. Lori Jacobson next, right here on Screen and Beyond. Today on Screen and Beyond, our guest is a writer, producer, historian, author, and she wrote and co-produced Mary Tyler Moore, the 20th anniversary show, as well as co-producing the TV special Funny Women of Television. And she has written several books, including her latest, Top of the Mountain, The Beatles at Shea Stadium, 1965. It's Lori Jacobson. Lori, welcome to On Screen and Beyond.
Well, thanks. Happy to be here.
Now, Lori, The Beatles. I mean, what can I say? I mean, I am a big fan. So, I needed to get you on here because of The Beatles and so much more you've done too. But boy, The Beatles really, that I see that and it's like, whoa, that's, I got to talk about that.
Well, I can't believe I got to write a book about The Beatles. After all these years of the Beatles being around, I would have thought that everything had been said at least once before. But I was incredibly fortunate to come across the details of a particular story that hadn't been told.
Really? Wow. Yeah.
I was friendly with a gentleman who was best friends with a guy named Sid Bernstein. Mm-hmm. And Sid ended up as the promoter of the Shea Stadium concert, 1965. That is the first rock and roll concert ever in a baseball stadium. And, of course, after that, all we saw were baseball stadiums. It changed rock and roll forever. And it really, it just changed everything.
Definitely.
Never before had anyone played for 56,000 people. Not Elvis, not Sinatra, nobody. Mm-hmm. And technology woke up the next morning and said, boy, did we screw up. No, nobody could see them. Nobody could hear them. And yet, 4 years later was Woodstock. So they had a heap of catching up to do, which they did over the next several years. Madison Avenue woke up the next morning and said, whoa, there's a whole group of people we're only selling pimple cream to, and we could be selling so much more to them. So, I mean, and the kids themselves, you know, looked around and saw 56,000 other people like them. Up to then, you're listening, you know, with 10 people around your parents' hi-fi, you know, to an album. And now you realize there are thousands and thousands of people like me that are interested in what I'm interested in. So many of the people that I interviewed who were there that day said it was utterly life-changing for them. And some of the people who were there that day were like a 16-year-old Meryl Streep is in the audience, a 9-year-old Whoopi Goldberg, 14-year-old Steve Van Zandt, two future Beatle wives were there. And come on, what are the odds of that? Mm-hmm. And one of them, Barbara Bach, who is married to Ringo, she brought her little sister. That's the only reason Barbara was there. She was not a Beatle fan, but her little sister was. And her little sister's future husband was there, Joe Walsh of the Eagles. So, you know, the more I delved into it, the more amazing the story was, and I just had a ball re-immersing myself in Beatlemania.
Yeah. Now, Laurie, this is a dumb question, but I know the answer to it, but were you a Beatles fan?
Yes. Huge Beatlemaniac.
All right. Were you a John, Paul, George, or Ringo fan?
Well, you know, it's changed over the years, but at the onset of Beatlemania, I was Paul all the way. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, and as I got older and more rebellious, it was definitely John. Mm-hmm. And then as I got older still and became more spiritual, it was George.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I love Ringo, don't get me wrong.
Oh, no.
He's amazing. But the other three kind of led me through my life here.
Yeah. I mean, all four are incredibly talented people. And, you know, the four of them together made music that, you know, will never be done again.
Yes. And, you know, and just, and with this particular concert, it could never happen this way again.
Yeah.
You know, that the simplicity of the time of the mid-60s and some beyond was just such a lovely and different time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Beatlemania that I, you know, the gift for me of writing this book was that I rediscovered my love and joy of the Beatles. You know, every time I'd hear an old Beatles song, I remember where I was when I first heard that. And it makes me feel great to hear it again. But I have lost the original drive and enthusiasm that I had as a kid. And the people that I spoke to that were at the concert, they still had it. They remembered, you know, they remembered every single detail of being there, what they wore, how they got there, how they got their tickets, what happened when they took the stage, just every moment. And so through them, I was able to find my way back to that original enthusiasm. And it's something I don't ever want to lose again.
Yeah.
Well, it just kind of gets buried under life.
Yeah. I can't imagine, you know, like you say, the technology wasn't there really for them to play a concert there, but the people couldn't hear them and they couldn't hear the, you know, themselves while they were playing. And it just seems like it was like, you know, who thought of this and didn't really plan on doing it right, you know?
Well, they thought, you know, they used what they had at the time. And they, you know, they had dozens of these long speakers set up in front of the stage, aimed out at the crowd. And there was a documentary shot that night during the concert, and to be safe, they had taped secondary microphones to the microphones that the Beatles were singing into, mm-hmm. so they would capture everything. But even that didn't work.
Yeah.
And yes, the Beatles couldn't even hear themselves. Ringo said the only way he knew what they were playing was by watching how their butts moved.
Right. I've seen that.
He had that down. So, you know, and after a while, you know, John would come to the mic to introduce the song, and he would just speak nonsense words. He just knew it doesn't matter what I say. They mm-hmm. can't hear me, you know, because the way Shea was built, you know, was really like an amphitheater, and the back end of Shea was open so that all of the noise coming from all of the screaming coming from the audience just barreled right down onto the stage.
Wow.
I mean, there were people who suffered permanent hearing loss that were on the field working the documentary and security. You can see in the movie, policemen grabbing their ears the moment the Beatles come out. I mean, it was just, you know, I think Paul said it was like standing next to a jet engine.
Jeez.
And then there were all kinds of people I interviewed that had other descriptions of what the sound was like. But that's the first thing everybody talked about was mm-hmm. the screaming, which was just overwhelming. And then also the crowd was throwing things. But they didn't get further than, you know, the front area seats. So
right.
the people sitting down below were just pelted with lipsticks and dolls that people had made and just all kinds of junk flying through the air.
Wow.
I know. It was just insane.
Oh, yeah.
It was absolutely insane.
Crazy. Oh, wow. So how'd you come up? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, other people that were there, Mick and Keith were there.
Really?
Yeah. Well, Alan Klein, sort of an infamous manager.
Yes.
Infamous in the Beatles, in rock and roll history. He managed a lot of people and many say stole a lot of money from them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was rather nefarious. Well, he had just signed the Stones, and his biggest client at that time was Bobby Vinton. So he wanted the Beatles in his stable, and he took a yacht, rented a yacht, and sailed around Manhattan Island with Mick and Keith and Bobby Vinton and then a bunch of other people in his party. And then they sailed to Shea Stadium and parked the yacht and went into the dressing rooms. And there Sid Bernstein, the promoter of the concert, was, and he had booked the Stones a number of times already in New York. And Mick approached Sid and said, "Gee, do you think we'll ever be able to play a stadium one day, Sid?" Sid told him, "Man, in a couple of years, I think you might get there." Yeah. So, you know, and Sid had the Rascals there. He had just signed the Rascals, and they were just, you know, I spoke to Felix, and he was just blown away to this day, just mm-hmm. blown away by, well, he said, I for for once we felt we're really in show business, you know, seeing that and being there for that.
Yeah. So in fact, Felix was on last week on my show.
Oh, you're kidding. Yeah. Oh, how fabulous. Yeah. He's great, isn't he?
Oh yeah. Yeah. He's doing good too. He's still going strong.
Yay. Yeah, he's an amazing guy.
I always ask, how do you come up with the title? So how did you get Top of the Mountain?
Oh, well, years later, after Shay, John Lennon was out with Sid Bernstein. They went to a reggae concert. And they were reminiscing, of course, about Shea Stadium. And John turned to him and said, I saw the top of the mountain on that unforgettable night. Hmm. And I thought, and it truly was the top of the mountain for their career, for Beatlemania. I mean, besides the impact that Shay had on rock and roll history and on the Beatles, within the following year, John had his infamous statement, we're more popular than Jesus now.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly people were burning Beatle albums and radio stations refused to play them. And they played Shay a year later and couldn't even sell it out.
Huh. Wow.
Whereas, you know, the year before it was oversold and they had to return thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah. But people, you know, they took it out of context, what he meant. I mean, you know, he didn't mean they were better or anything like that, you know, and it's just the way the media turns around and, you know, they'll just direct it in the wrong way.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, if you compare it to the internet now and someone says, you know, the words I say, you know, mm-hmm. reach more people than Jesus's words. You
right.
know, it was something similar to in meaning to
right.
that, which would be true because, you know, never before has communication spread so wide.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that's basically what he meant. But yeah, it was taken out of context. It was said at home to someone who was in the media, but someone John thought he was talking to privately.
Yeah.
And she ran with that ball and did a lot of damage. So, you know, does make Shay the top of the mountain for their career. Mm. It was just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, with Shea Stadium, you know, like you say, it was the first time that was done. And not too many years after that, they stopped doing those things because it must have been so taxing on them to do that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, 66 was their last tour, so they only toured for one more year.
Wow.
And as Ringo said, people came to see us. They didn't come to hear us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but at that point, the Beatles, especially John and Paul, their songwriting was getting more complicated. It was, you know, they were moving away from I Want to Hold Your Hand. And, you know, by 67, you had Sgt. Pepper's,
mm-hmm.
which would have been extremely difficult to do live.
Yeah.
And they just wanted to spend more time in the studio and grow. They were having, I guess, a major growth spurt. So, and they wanted people to hear the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, they had to be locked in their rooms and they couldn't, it wasn't like they could ever see the places they went to.
Right.
You know, here I'm thinking, gosh, they toured Europe several times. They must have gained some sophistication. No. You know, in Europe, they could go out a little bit more to clubs at night. But, you know, in the States, they couldn't move out of their hotel. Their hotel was surrounded by thousands and thousands of people.
And, you know, it's amazing that here we are, you know, getting almost 60 years since that famous time that they were at the stadium. And Paul is still out there doing shows two and a half hours long, and it's incredible.
Yes, Paul and Ringo and Mick and Keith and Felix.
Yep.
He's still playing. You know, it's a really unique generation.
Oh, yeah.
And they all started out thinking, you know, we'll do this for a couple of years. And when it goes away, as it inevitably will, you know, I'll do something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I spoke to Steve Boone, who from the Love and Spoonful.
Yes.
They were at Shea 66. But he was just talking about the Beatles being the first to write their own music. He was speaking about the end of the era of really the 50s, where you went to the Brill Building in New York, which was full of songwriters, and you'd say, I want a song about a boy meeting a girl and losing the girl and then getting her back in the end. Oh, well, that's in room 302. You know, the guy in room 302 has a song just for you. And you would take your artist up there and you would hear the song and the artist would record it. And that would be that. And the artist wouldn't really have a lot of input into it or make it his own. It was very formulaic.
Yeah.
And the Beatles changed all of that when they wrote their own music. So it was an amazing time.
Oh yeah, no doubt about it. He's still both. Paul, Ringo, they're both still coming out with more music, new music, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, did you know that they're both playing on the new Stones album?
I heard that, and I also heard that Paul, I don't know about Ringo, is going to be doing a duet with Dolly Parton on her album.
Oh, really? Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, Dolly Parton, I heard, was coming out with a rock and roll album because she's never had an official rock and roll album, and she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all that. But she is doing an album, and I think Mick, I don't have the information in front of me, so I don't remember, but there were several big, you know, artists from that time period that she's going to be doing duets with. So that could be an interesting album.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yes, Dolly Parton duets, of course. That should have happened a long time ago, but I'm really thrilled that it's happening now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And like you say, with the Stones, and it's just incredible that they're still going so strong at this time.
Yeah, it really is. And now my favorite part of the story has to do with Sid Bernstein and how this whole thing came to be. To show the simplicity of the time, Sid Bernstein is the guy who discovered the Beatles in America. Everybody thinks that was Ed Sullivan, but Ed Sullivan jumped on Sid's bandwagon. Sid was taking a class. He believed in always doing something to improve yourself. So he was taking a class, and the homework assignment was to read newspapers from other countries. And he could only read English, so he read the British papers. And, of course, he turned right to the entertainment section. And he kept seeing these little blurbs about a group called the Beatles playing in smaller towns in the UK and in Germany. And the word pandemonium was always attached to the review. So he, you know, began following them and decided that he must bring them over to the United States. So he reached out to Brian Epstein and actually, you know, basically said, can you come out to play? And Brian's mother answered the phone and said, just a minute, I'll get him. America's calling. You know, Brian had hoped for months and months. He had been trying to attract someone in America's to this group that he managed, but no one responded. Here was the first call. This guy wanted to bring them over to play Carnegie Hall. And he said, but we're not even being played in America. And he said, I'll set it far enough ahead that people will know who you are. And during that time, Ed Sullivan and his wife are traveling. They land at Heathrow in the UK on a day when the Beatles are coming back to the UK. And there's hundreds of screaming girls at the airport. And Ed inquired about it, found out that Sid was bringing them to the U.S., and asked Sid, who booked people on the Sullivan Show all the time. He called Sid and said, would you mind if they appeared on my show the same weekend you're bringing them to the States? And he said, no, that's perfect. That'll guarantee me a sellout show.
Right.
So everyone associates the Beatles' introduction to the U.S. with Ed Sullivan, but it was all Sid.
Wow.
So with that happening, Sid then becomes the conduit for the British invasion. All the British groups are calling Sid, the Animals, the Stones, Herman's Hermits, the Dave Clark Five,
yeah,
anybody who wanted to come over to the U.S. And Sid is booking them on a show called Hullabaloo, mm-hmm, a weekly show that featured rock and rollers. And he's really happening, and he's delighted. But he ends up booking the Animals in New York for five nights in a row, and that was a big mistake. Because the Beatles could play five nights in a row and fill up the theater, but the Animals filled up the theater for two nights, and the last three were empty, and he lost a lot of money.
Oh, wow.
And he had just had a child, and he was in a terrible way. His wife was furious. He didn't know what he was going to do. So he's out walking one day and eating. He was always eating. He was quite a large guy. He knew where the best music and the best food in New York was. And he thought, well, I know, who do I know? The biggest group in entertainment in the world I have a great relationship with. What's the biggest place I could book them into? And he thought, Madison Square Garden isn't big enough. I want bigger. And he settled on Shea Stadium. And when he told Brian about it, Brian said, no way. You know, the Beatles at that point were still getting mixed reviews from older people, mm-hmm, in the U.S. They're a passing fad. Next year they'll be bald and you'll forget all about them. And Brian said, my boys don't play to empty seats, mm-hmm, or the naysayers will point and say, see, I told you.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
So Sid said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $10 for every empty seat in Shea Stadium. That's how sure I am that I can fill it.
Hmm. Wow.
And so Brian said, all right, I'll take that deal. I want a guarantee of $100,000, which was enormous.
Yeah, for that time, yeah.
Enormous. And I want half of it in 3 months, and you can't advertise the concert until you give me $50,000. Hmm. And he said, well, how am I going to raise that kind of money if I can't advertise it? And Brian said, well, I didn't say you couldn't talk about it. So here's my favorite part. Sid went to Washington Square Park in New York every day. He got himself a post office box. He went to the park every day, and he told teenagers, I'm bringing the Beatles to Shea Stadium in August. And that cry went around the world. Mm-hmm. In 3 weeks, he finally had the courage to go to the P.O. box to see if he had any orders. And they had bags and they came out from the back of the post office to finally meet the guy who had this box. They had bags and bags and bags of mail for him. And when he took it home, he and his wife were opening letters, and yen fell out of one envelope. Rubles fell out of another envelope. Money came from behind the Iron Curtain. Wow. You know, so at a time when there was only letter writing, mm-hmm. and long distance phone calls, the news of the Beatles playing Shea Stadium went around the world. It was a network of teenagers. Yep. You know, and I thought, oh my, when I heard that part of the story, I thought, you know, obviously with the internet, nothing like this could ever happen again. You know, places sell out in 30 minutes. Ask Taylor Swift,
right.
You know.
Jeez.
But, you know, at a time where it was just teenagers writing to each other and making phone calls while their parents were in the background saying, get off the phone, it's a long distance. You know,
the beginnings of social media.
You know, it was just so fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, he was truly, Sid was truly the Pied Piper of rock and roll. Hmm. They followed him through the streets of New York. They camped out in front of his building. You know, he was the one, the conduit to rock, and now he was definitely the conduit to the Beatles. And he took in over $300,000 with that concert, which again was the highest take of in show business history to that point.
Yeah.
And Sid, God love him, he could hear, he could recognize talent, you know, miles away, but he was lousy with numbers. He took home $3,000.
Boy, oh boy. You would think for something, you know, for something like that, he would have brought home, you know, buckets of money. You
know? Yeah. I mean, the Beatles were only promised $100,000 of that.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, they took home $160,000, and the rest of the money, you know, Sid, I don't know what, you know, it's hard to know exactly what happened, because, hey, didn't he even have to advertise the concert?
Right. Yeah.
Jeez. You know, it was already sold out. Yeah. So.
Huh. That's weird. But have you ever had a chance to meet any of the Beatles?
I have not.
But you'd like to, right?
Yeah, sure. Heck yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I say in the introduction, one of my biggest regrets in life, I lived in New York. It was, I guess, the spring of 74. It was the first beautiful spring day after a long winter, and my roommate and I went to Central Park, and there were just people all over out, you know, and there were old men playing fiddles, and there were Puerto Ricans playing steel drum music, and it was just coming from every corner, and we went to the east, and when we came back, hordes of people were coming from the west, and they said, oh man, John Lennon was just playing in the park. Oh,
wow.
And I was like, really? So I went the wrong way that day. And I wonder what it would have been like to see him in an unprotected area like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just sitting cross-legged on the grass.
Right.
I think it probably would have changed my life, because they were so untouchable.
Yeah.
Well, but I blew that.
Yeah. One of the things that I did get the opportunity, like I say, I've seen Paul many times, but we were at Paul McCartney's waiting outside to get into the stadium to see him. and somebody was going around there handing out tickets, and we didn't know what it was for. And we said, you know, what's that for? And they said, here, you can have two tickets. I said, well, what is it for? And they said, it's for a concert tomorrow with 1,000 people in the stadium, and they're going to be filming to, you know, they film the concert, but then they film, you know, like other shots, I guess. And they needed a crowd of 1,000 people down in the front, and they would turn around and then edit it into the movie. It was for Paul's, I can't remember, was it the Get Back, his movie, his documentary movie.
Okay.
Do you remember that one?
Yes.
Anyways, so it was for that one. And, you know, I called into work and said, okay, I'm not coming in tomorrow because we're staying down here. And we got to see Paul in a very intimate, you know, for 1,000 people, which, you know, sounds like a lot of people, but when you're in the stadium, you know, it's what, 5 rows, maybe, you know, people are standing by the stage. And he, you know, while they were setting up the cameras, they were turning around and he's playing around, just, you know, playing whatever and just wasting time. And it was like, you know, then people were leaving, you know, because it's a long process. I don't know if you know, I'm sure, a lot about TV shows and how things can drag and everything. And people were leaving, and I'm thinking, you know, it was about 4 hours later, and I'm thinking, why are they leaving? You know, I mean, we're here with Paul McCartney, you know, you know, you're close enough. You can spit on him if you want, you know, I mean,
but, oh, wow.
So that was really amazing. Something. Yeah, that was quite a thing. But anyway, so where can people get the book?
Wherever books are sold, you know, always Amazon and Barnes and Noble and all those kinds of places. And if they want a signed copy, they can just write me at my website, lauriejacobson.com, and I'll be happy to sign a copy of it and send it out to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I was just thinking with your story, I did get to see the Beatles in 66.
Really? Wow.
So, and I saw George touring in, I think it was 74, which they refer to as the cocaine tour, when he was experiencing a little vocal disruption due to all the coke he was doing at that time.
Yeah.
And of course I've seen Paul and Ringo almost every time they've toured. So at least I did get to see them all in one place.
Mm.
And I wasn't a screamer. You know, I was a crier. I just kind of knew this is it for me. This is my moment with them. And I want to hear everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeez. Yeah.
Hi, this is Dr. Demento, and you're listening to On Screen and Beyond.
Now, we're going to switch gears a little bit here because
okay.
You've done so much other stuff, and I want to get as much as I can in here. Now, you started out as a comedian. Is this correct? Or stand-up comedian and improv? Is that right?
Well, yeah, I pursued an acting career, and I like to say that I was an excellent waitress during that time. And I did discover the world of comedy improv when I moved to L.A. I was in school in New York, and then I moved to L.A., and I very early on discovered a guy named Harvey Lembeck, and he had this great comedy workshop with these really funny, undiscovered people named, you know, Robin Williams and John Ritter and John LaRoquette living in his car.
Wow.
On Laurel Canyon Boulevard, you know, so it was an amazing time. I mean, clearly we knew, you know, there was no doubt that Robin was going to be incredible. You know, I felt guilty writing people back at home and saying, keep your eyes peeled for a guy named Robin Williams. You know? But yes. And so many of those people came from the world of stand-up. So I did dabble in that for a while. Yeah.
Now, did you actually get to meet Harvey Limbeck? I mean, if people that might not know by the name, he was a comedian, a lot of movies he was in. I remember him most for the beach. I don't know if it was Beach Blank and Bingo or one of those beach movies with Frankie and Annette. He was Eric Von Zipper.
Right. He was the leader of the motorcycle gang and all of them. And he often said his friends made fun of him for doing that. But he said, I worked with Buster Keaton. I worked with, amazing people on those films. So the hell with them.
Yeah. Did you get to meet him?
Oh, yeah. He ran the workshop.
Oh, he did? Okay. Well, I didn't know if it was, like his name only and, they had people that worked for him. I wasn't sure.
No, and his friend, and also his friends, and his friends were, Phil Foster and Gary Marshall and Hackett and, people like that were saying, you can't teach comedy. You can't teach comedy. But you could.
Yeah.
You could. We learned a tremendous amount. And then his friends would come and work out with us, Joey Bishop and Jack Lemmon. Oh, wow. It was thrilling. It was a thrilling place to be. And for a while in my class, Peter Noon.
Yeah.
From Herman's Hermits,
yes.
Started working out with us because he had been an actor.
Right. He was. I'm trying to think what something, a millionaire. He was in a movie. I can't remember.
And I think he did soap opera stuff.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
In the UK, as a teen.
Yeah.
And, once he brought one of his friends to sit in on the class, and it was Dave Clark.
Mm-hmm. Of the Dave Clark Five.
And I'm like, oh my God. I thought this is just, it was like 77. Their albums were still hot on my stereo, So it was really an incredible time and experience. So Comedy Improv was awesome.
Yeah. Now you also co-produced the Mary Tyler Moore 20th anniversary show, correct?
Yes.
And how was it working? I mean, I actually have had a lot of the people who were on that, Gavin McLeod, and of course he's passed,
yes, they all have, really.
Yeah, I think now, but I didn't have all except of that. Ed Asner I have had on, Valerie Hopper, and I mean, just that was such an incredible show, and you must have been thrilled to work with those people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Mary Tyler Moore, forget it. And everyone was so kind. First of all, they had not all been together as a group since the show had ended. And during that time, Ted Knight had passed away. So it was a very emotional reunion for them to begin with.
I'm sure.
And they were just at the top of their game, so happy to be back together. Full of laughter and memories. And then, and we had made these clip packages with themes. And when we played the Ted Knight clip package, they were crying.
I'm sure.
Yeah. So it was just, Mary's bad dates, Mary's bad parties. everybody had their own package of clips, and it was just so fun. But this is the story that I tell about that weekend that we filmed. Mary, of course, she brought the hat that she throws in the air, and she brought the M that hung on the wall of her apartment through the entire series.
Yeah,
and her husband was there. And he was telling me that at one point Mary auctioned off the M for a charity she believed in, and he spent $10,000 to purchase it back for her.
Wow.
So and I'm thinking, wow, this is so amazing, right? So we have the M. Now we're down to the last shot of the show, which is Mary's goodbye. Everybody else in the cast has gone home. and she's in the dressing room getting ready for that shoot, and the prop man dropped the M.
Ooh.
And it broke into like 50 pieces.
And that was his last job, right? On the show.
You know, the whole set froze, and he is gathering up the pieces, this poor man, you know, and running away, trying to glue it together. And he brings it back, and he's re-spray painted it, but it looked like shit. It looked terrible. And you know, the director said, if we tell her, we might never get this last shot. She could break down into tears and, you know, and so we have to get this shot. So we're not going to tell her. So now everyone on the set is keeping this huge secret from Mary. You know, we're all complicit. And she comes out and she's all bubbly and she walks to her spot and she sees the M and immediately knows and turns on a dime and says, excuse me for a moment, please, and goes back into her dressing room. And now we're all just dying. What will happen? What will happen? And 20 minutes later, she came out, walked to her spot and said, let's get that last shot.
Wow.
And she never asked what happened, who did it. You know, she was just a complete pro.
Yeah.
And, you know, she could have, yes, had that guy blackballed, fired, fined, you know, and many others would have.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, accidents happen.
It just happened
to be with a memento of hers that meant a huge amount to her. And I just thought, wow, that was a great lesson in being a pro.
And I never had the opportunity to get Cloris Leachman on the show here, but I've met Cloris several times, and I just kept trying to get her on, but we couldn't arrange it. And then, of course, she's passed and everything. But Cloris Leachman must have been – I don't know how she was when you were filming the show, but Cloris was a handful.
Yes, she was. She was a completely neurotic.
Yeah. Oh, she was just crazy in a good way. And I mean that in a good way.
Yes. You know, she, you know, and also I have to say Betty White was just beyond.
Really?
Beyond kind, fabulous human being. Just so sweet. So funny. So damn funny. You know, and everyone, really. Ed Asner was great. Gavin was wonderful. Yeah. As a matter of fact, Gavin had told me that he had a fire at his house and he had lost all of his tapes of the show.
Oh.
And so I made, back then we were still on videotape, I made tapes of all the shows that featured him. And he was so grateful. And years later, he's on a plane and my dad was on the same plane. So my dad, being a dad, approaches him in his seat and says, you know, I'm Laurie's father. And immediately, years later, he goes, oh, my gosh, your daughter was so kind to make those videos for me. And so they were just real people, you know.
Yeah, when I interviewed him, he was just so nice, you know, just such a nice guy.
A lot of heart. They all you can just see why it lasted. And you know, that last scene where they move as a group, you know, truly, truly. And, you know, Cloris was such a nut. She was just such a, you know, my husband, John Provost, who was Timmy on Lassie, and Cloris played his mother on the show for half a season.
Yes.
Which most people don't recall. You know, we saw Cloris often at comic cons and autograph shows, and she was just a nut.
Oh, yes.
The woman was just a nut.
So much fun.
Yes. Yes. So funny and such an offbeat character and a just a brilliant actress.
Yeah. Yeah.
A beautiful woman too. She was great, but she did get on the director's nerves during that shoot, I recall.
I can see why. I understand
she
that.
She was very needy. She was very needy, where the others were not needy at all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Laurie, this has been so much fun. It's just this. You have so much knowledge and such great stories to tell. That's why you're a historian. That's a Hollywood historian. And I would love to have you on again, maybe around Halloween or something, if we could get you, because you know a lot about the haunted Hollywood, correct?
I do. And, you know, that was my most popular book, Hollywood Haunted. Mm-hmm. And I just wrestled the rights away from my publisher, and it's mine again. And they had cut many chapters from the book originally, and so I'm putting all those chapters back in, and I'm re-releasing it just a little bit later this year. The author's cut.
Okay. And now I want to get in here too that you have re-released the Timmy's in the Well, correct? With more information and more pictures and things?
Yes. Yes. My husband's autobiography. It just came out a couple of weeks ago, and it has been updated to through Christmas of 2022. With lots more photos, maybe 100 new photos.
Wow.
So, so we're really happy about that as well.
You can't get any hotter off the press than that. That's for sure. Up to date. That's for sure.
Yeah, we're up to date.
Yeah.
So it's been fun. So I'm still working on Hollywood Haunted, and that should be done in the next couple of months here. And I would love to talk to you about it at Halloween.
Yeah, that would be, you know, a good time. I was thinking that would be, you know, the appropriate time to get everybody in the mood and everything.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. And now, Laurie, I want to finish up with one final question.
Okay.
And it takes us away from all your books, which we'll get into more, the next time you're on, because there's other books too. I don't want to, you know, stay away from those, but you've got a lot of other books too. Taking us away from that in your Top of the Mountain, The Beatles at Shea Stadium, 1965, which everybody should go out and get. But when you sit back and relax, what are your favorite TV shows now and from when you were growing up in the past? And what are your favorite movies now and in the past?
Oh, wow. You couldn't have emailed that to me to let me do a little thinking about it. Oh, that is so tough. And my favorite TV shows, I think I still watch them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I love Dick Van Dyke. I love Cheers and Taxi. And my films, my favorite films. Like my mind has just gone blank.
I know, that's what usually happens. But when you're flicking the channels or whatever, going through the streaming and all that stuff, or is there a movie that you might, you know, you've seen 100 times, 1,000 times, but every time you see that it's there, you got to sit down and watch it again?
You know, it's not that old, but Tombstone, I feel that way about.
Ah, yeah.
If it's playing, I will always watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, where is that notebook I have with my favorite films written in it that I can't, it's so hard. I mean, I feel cliche, of course, with Wizard of Oz most Hitchcock films.
Mm-hmm.
Woo!
Well, I'll tell you, Laurie, when we talk again around Halloween, I always ask that as my final question, so you can think about it.
Okay, I'll be better prepared.
Okay.
I promise.
No problem. Yeah. Well, Laurie, I thank you so much for joining us and sharing. Your stories are great, and it's so good to hear those things. And I want to remind people one more time that your latest book is out, and it is called Top of the Mountain, The Beatles at Shea Stadium, 1965. And they should go out and get that, or like you say, go to your website, and they can get it autographed and get a book there.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all those places. I will be at the Beatle Fest in New Jersey at the end of the month. And I'm really looking forward to that. And, you know, it's just been a fab trip.
And a big thank you going out to Laurie Jacobson for joining us here at On Screen and Beyond. Fascinating things that she had done. And of course, if you were a Beatles fan, you don't want to miss her latest book, Top of the Mountain, The Beatles at Shea Stadium, 1965. So be sure to check that out. It's available on Amazon and all the other places that you can get books. And it's a fascinating, you know, if you, like you say, if you're a Beatles fan, it's something you want. And once again, I want to remind you about the Golden Girls tribute convention coming up called Behind the Golden Curtain on May 26th to the 28th at the Rinda Theater. It's a tribute to the Golden Girls TV show with all kinds of the writers and directors and producers of the show and people who guest starred on the show. They're going to have all kinds of fun things going on, very similar to, you know, what went on at the last one they had for the Land of the Lost. And that was a great time if you were there. But this one's going to be keying on the Golden Girls. So Behind the Golden Curtain, be sure to check that out May 26th to the 28th. And that's it. That's a wrap for this episode of On Screen and Beyond. So until next time, when we once again take you on screen and beyond, I'm Brian Simrak. Take care.